It said that at one time, when the Buddha was teaching, a great gathering came to hear him, and a very large number of people. And attracted to that gathering was an outcast, a leper. He was very, lived on the margins of society, and people shunned him. And it said that he was attracted to the gathering because he thought there might be some good food on offer. But the Buddha, when with his divine eye, he scanned the minds of the people that were present, he realized that this very person, Super Buddha the leper, that's what his name was the most able, would be the most able to understand his teaching. And so he directed his teaching to this person, who wasn't actually in the frame of mind to hear anything, just wanted some good food. But then as the Buddha started to speak, and he spoke his graduated teaching, beginning with the benefits of generosity, the benefits of ethics, the benefits of cultivating wholesome karma, the drawbacks of sensual pleasure, and the rewards of renunciation. These were the classical graduated teaching. Then he saw that actually this person, his mind started to become more open and malleable and bright and receptive. And then the Buddha saw that his mind was ready. For as it said in the sutta, in the teaching, for the teaching peculiar to the Buddhas, which is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And so then he gave this teaching, and through hearing this teaching, it said that Super Buddha the leper awakened, his mind released. The spotless vision of the Dharma arose, and he saw what he hadn't seen before. So this teaching on the Four Truths is something that is really important for us to have a working understanding of, because it's a working teaching. It's a living teaching. It's a teaching that takes us and carries us and supports us in all our activities throughout our whole life. It's the teaching that presents the doorway to deeper understanding and inner freedom. And it's, in many ways, it's a very accessible teaching, which is why the Buddha taught it. He didn't start off from understanding this himself. It said that what began his journey, he was like us. He lived a life of comfort. Said that he had everything that he needed. Lived in these comfortable homes. Was surrounded by beauty. And things that were disturbing were removed from his sight and from his presence. In the same way that we try to create our lives now with the power that we have to manipulate the world to make us comfortable, pleasant lives. But then at a certain point he became curious. What is outside my comfort zone? What is outside the palace? And where I'm protected and cosseted. And so he took a journey one day, and during that journey it said he saw four signs, which are classically taught as the four heavenly messengers. And these were the first sign was to see someone that was very sick. The second sign was someone that was aged and decrepit. And then the third sign was a corpse, a dead person. And the fourth sign was a seeker, someone that was very radiant and peaceful, a practitioner. But these first three signs disturbed him. And one can think, well, how can it be that a young man at 29 years of age didn't really see these things before? Especially living where he lived, northern India. But we see these things a lot, but there was something about the seeing of them in that moment that penetrated into his heart. He understood the impermanence of life, and it said at that point he uttered the words that the vanity of youth left him. The vanity of life and permanence disappeared, fled. This inner subtle, sometimes and not so subtle, vanity that we have as human beings as we build our monuments in the shifting sands that will be here forever. This is our vanity. We create our empires only really for them at some point to crumble. He hadn't really seen through that vanity, but when he saw something that really disturbed him, the reality of the not beautiful, it awakened him. It disturbed him enough that he started his journey. It initiated his quest. So we can look at this story and think, oh, well, it was about someone a long time ago, a great saint. But it's really an archetypal journey that mirrors into our lives, because at a certain point we too awaken to impermanence. We too get disturbed by realities of life that shake our vanities of control and of being able to manipulate the world for pleasure and comfort. And it disturbs us. And when the Buddha experienced these things, it said that he began his journey with the quest, is there anything that doesn't die? Is there anything in this mortal realm that is free from the touch of death? And so he left his comfort zone, as we in our very small way have left our comfort zone to come on retreat for this quest. And he began his journey. He walked and found the sages of the time and practiced with them, the great practitioners, who are great yogis, Olympic meditators, and he learnt everything that they learnt. In fact, he surpassed them. He was someone that had a lot of skill and intelligence and natural capacity. A lot of what they, in Thailand, they would say barami, a lot of virtue. Accumulated wholesome karma. So when he practiced, he came to be able to develop those practices very quickly. In fact, so much so that the teachers that he learnt with very soon said, well, won't you take over the school and won't you become the teacher? But he knew that he hadn't really cracked this nugget of a question. He had learnt these very subtle meditations where he could go beyond the realms of form and absorb into refined states of consciousness, where there was not even any sense of perception or the sense of nothingness. It was just so refined, so peaceful, so subtle. Sense of the body is gone, sense of everything is gone. But then he always found that he would come down from those meditations. They weren't permanent. They also weren't permanent. As we have found in our retreat, we have moments of peace and we can taste that. And it's like, if only we could hold that. And then something shifts. We have to get up and eat, or someone disturbs, or just the state changes, or we become sleepy. So this too, he realized, even the most refined states of consciousness that he could engineer were unstable. So then he began to feel, well, maybe the problem was his body was in the way. The needs of the body and the pressure and the heaviness and the pull of embodiment and the world of form. The world was the problem. If only he could really overcome his bodily impulses and needs, then he would be free. You know, it's like when we sit here and then we feel this heaviness after eating, or we feel the sleepiness and we can feel, oh, the body has pain, and we can feel this is a problem. You know, it gets in the way from our peace and from our pleasure. So then he set about finding other kinds of practitioners that he learnt from, who were great ascetics, renunciants that had refined these incredible practices to crush the needs of the body. And it's said that he entered these practices for 6 years and became again very adept at them. I don't know what they were exactly, but he landed up becoming so emaciated. One of them he began to feel that eating was a problem. So he reduced his eating until he took like a few grains of rice a day. And then he perhaps even thought breathing was a problem. Too disturbing even to breathe. So he would try sometimes not to breathe. So the movement of life disturbed him. So he tried to stop it and tried to crush. And then just at the point when he took it to such an extreme that he was at the point of near death, it said that at that point this woman had been watching him and looking at this great practitioner and was a bit worried about him. It's like, wow, this guy's pretty intense. He's but it looks like he's going to die. So it said that she came, her name was Sujata, she came with some milk rice and presented this to the Buddha and said, well, won't you eat something? You need some nourishment. And at that point, the Buddha had got to the place where he realized that if he continued, even perhaps another day, he would surely die, that he took the offering and ate. And he realized that he needed nourishment, he needed to honor and take care of this body. It was his vehicle for his practice. And in a way, the woman coming to him was a symbol, symbolic of an opening to another way, leaving the path of pain and then finding what he called the middle way. Before he was caught up in pleasure, then he was caught up in asceticism, and then he began the journey of accepting by welcoming the body, nourishing the body, welcoming and being willing to be in the world of form. It's a subtle but quite profound shift. This is the world of form that we're incarnated into, and a lot of the time we struggle against it. So this shifting of being nourished. And then he had the energy to begin his path again. And at that point, another thing happened, which was a memory. A memory came to him to show him from within. At that point, when he took the milk rice, his friends, his great tough practitioners that he'd been practicing with, looked at him and said, wow, look at him, he's gone slack. He's taken some milk rice from a woman. God, they were disgusted. And so they said that they walked away and left him. And then he'd practiced with the teachers and no one could teach him anymore. He'd learnt everything and it still didn't quite work. So there was a moment of utter aloneness where all the ways that had gone before were closed to him. He travelled them all and they still hadn't produced the answer that he was looking for, the realization that he was searching for. And at that moment, it's like his own psyche, in the same way as the mysterious appearance of the woman, his own psyche, his own deeper intuitive guide arose and presented him with a memory that he had that was significant for him. And it was a memory of when he was a child, when he wasn't caught up in striving and struggling, and he remembered how the innocence of the child that he was, and how that he had sat one day very peacefully under a tree, removed himself from the plowing festival that was happening within the village. And then as he sat there, began to be with his body and breath in the way that we've been practicing, and that he remembered that that was very pleasant and very peaceful and very profound. And it said that he realized that was a pleasure, the pleasure of meditation that wasn't to be feared and was to be developed. And so with that memory, and then in a way freed from the shackles of all the previous pathways, he walked to Bodh Gaya, what is now called Bodh Gaya, Gaya, and sat under the Bodhi tree and practiced during the night of his awakening, the night of his enlightenment. He sat through the night. He was prepared. The mind was ready to inquire free from the past and from all the different pathways, and open with that mind of a child almost to see freshly. And it said then through the night, at first, everything that came up to challenge him, all his fears and desires, all the longings, all the sense of duty, what are you doing here, you should be home. You might have heard something like that. You know, everything that overwhelmed him through the night, every force, said the force of Mara, the archetypal, that which embodies ignorance and keeps us deluded, appeared a huge array before him. You know, all those voices, who do you think you are and what are you doing, and it's useless and give up, and isn't there something more pleasing that you can be doing, and, you know, what about going out to see a movie? So he sat there and he just, rather than struggle with those forces, he just simply said, I know you. I know you, Mara. I know you. I know these energies. I know these hindrances. And I'm not going to be shaped by you and overwhelmed by you or react to you. I just know you. And the power of that knowing, it said Mara slunk away and said, oh, the Buddha Sakyamuni, he knows me. And his power dissipated. He didn't have any more power. And so those moments of just knowing that which terrifies us, like a ghost in the night, and just turn on the light of illumination, and it disappears. And as he sat through the night, it said the three knowledges peculiar to the Buddha, to an awakened one, arose within him. The knowledge, the first great knowledge, was all of his past lives. He said he could see where he'd been born, in what kind of culture, and what kind of food, and what kind of situation, and who he had been with, and who his friends were. So he could track this great journey through many, many lives. And then he could see the karma and the lives of many, many other beings that he looked at. This is the second great knowledge. And the third great knowledge was the knowledge that really liberated him. It's the knowledge where he understood and he saw what's called avijja paccaya sankhara, the force of ignorance, avijja, not seeing clearly, the nature, the mind not really knowing its deeper nature. It seeks birth, it seeks a resting place, it seeks an identity in the shifting sands of change within the mortal realm. It's called avijja, ignorance, propels paccaya, conditions, sankhara, this movement into creating a patterning, an identification with a me, through the identification with what's called the five khandhas, thoughts and forms and feelings and perceptions and moments of sensory consciousness. We again and again create this patterning and this identification of me as something and someone, doing something and going somewhere. And at that moment, in the night of his enlightenment, he saw through that compound, that structure, and it completely collapsed. The ignorance of the mind completely dried up. And this is what he said, as is recorded. Through many a birth in existence I wandered, seeking but not finding the builder of this house. Sorrowful is repeated existence. O house builder, thou have been seen, thou shalt build no house again. All thy rafters are broken, thy ridgepole is shattered. My mind has attained the deathless. Achieved is the end of all craving. This house builder is this movement to create the sense of self, the sense of time, the sense of going somewhere. The mind is constantly seeking a home, a house. And it was through his ability to see through that and disidentify that he got to the end of that process, the end of the creation of sankhara, and tasted peace, tasted the uncreated. At one point, when he taught, he said, if there wasn't this uncreated, this unborn, this unoriginated, this amata dhatu, this deathless element, then there would be no freedom. This is very subtle. So subtle that after his awakening, it said that he sat there in bliss. His mind was free. After all this struggle, all of this questing, all of this hard practice, the moment of liberation must have been very blissful. And so he was so blissful that he even spent one whole week just gazing at the tree that had protected him through his practice that night with eyes unblinking or with great devotion and great love. And also at that point he touched the earth so that the earth herself bore witness to all his many lives, all the struggles, to the moment, and confirmed his deepest knowing nature, that which is peaceful. He knew that which is transcends death. But he also was quite challenged. How do you communicate this? It was quite a subtle understanding. And it said actually at that time someone came past and saw, who then he became the Buddha, the awakened one. His personal name dropped away. And this guy saw him and said, wow, you look pretty amazing. You're pretty radiant, blissful. Who are you? What are you about? And the Buddha said, I am the all-world conqueror. I am the world transcender. And the guy said, well, okay. Who's your teacher? And he said, I don't have a teacher. Who can teach me? I'm self-taught, you know. So he was like, really gave this lion's roar. I'm enlightened. There is only enlightenment. It's like a non-dual kind of statement. And the guy really said that he looked at the Buddha and sort of like, nice for you, and left. And so that's called the Buddha's first failed sermon. That it was a truthful statement, the statement of all of our truth when we really are not under the sway of ignorance anymore. But it couldn't, wasn't communicated. Guy couldn't get it. And so he pondered. He was reluctant how to communicate. It's the same issue, not quite as the issue of the Buddha, of course, but when we go home and people say, well, what have you been doing? It's like, well, I've been sitting and doing nothing and not speaking for a week or two, you know, and it sounds a bit, you know, what? It's hard to communicate this Dhamma, what it's about. So, and yet it's so consuming. And so it said that he eventually, well, actually he decided he wasn't going to bother. Too difficult. And, you know, anyone that tries to teach this stuff can really, I can empathize. But at that point, the devas appeared. A great angelic being came before the Buddha called Brahma Sahampati and bowed before him and said, please, there are those with a little dust in their eye that will, will be able to understand, and for the lack of not hearing, if they don't hear your message, they won't really have the opportunity to find peace, to know liberation. So for out of compassion for those, please go forth and turn the wheel of the Dhamma. You know, so this is the bringing of the insight back into the world of form, a journey back into living it. And so the Buddha walked to Bodh Gaya, from Bodh Gaya to Varanasi. It's probably quite a long walk. And then by the time he got to Varanasi, he kind of figured out a different approach. And as he came to the place where it said that he taught his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, that his previous companions that had given up on him when he took the milk rice saw him and said, oh, here comes that slacker, the Buddha, the Gotama. They didn't call him the Buddha then. Here comes that guy, you know, he gave up, he took milk rice, he ate something. he started breathing again. You know, let's not respect him. But then as he came near, he had such radiancy and such power about him that they couldn't help but prepare a seat. And then as he sat down, he started with his turnings called the first great turning of the Dhamma wheel with this teaching on the four truths. There is this experience of dukkha. Dukkha has a cause. That cause of dukkha can be overcome. There can be freedom from dukkha, and there is a path bringing about the ending of dukkha. In a way, it's not starting from the place of enlightenment, it's starting from an experience that we have every single day. There is this experience of dukkha, translated usually as suffering. I don't know what the translation would be in Hebrew, but it's something like the word is that which is difficult to bear, or that which sometimes it has this idea of a wheel that doesn't turn well. Sometimes it has the idea of that which is apart from the akash, the space, or the perfection, or the wholeness. That which is unsatisfactory, that is associated with stress. There is this experience of suffering. This is what we have been meeting and resisting like mad on our retreat, or trying to struggle with, or trying to work with. There is this experience of dukkha. And usually when we aren't very mindful or reflective, or haven't really heard, understood this kind of a teaching, usually we spend our time resisting and repressing the experience of suffering. Well, mostly what we do is distract ourselves. We have incredible, sophisticated industries of entertainment that help us distract and move all the time. Or we blame ourselves. You know, if I'm suffering, it's because there's something wrong with me. Or we blame someone else. We project it out. It's because of them that, you know, that I feel like this. It's because of you that I have suffering. And it can be true. But this is this kind of suffering that the Buddha is talking about that can be overcome is the certain kind of suffering that comes from the ignorance of the mind. It is true that we can feel pain and be caused pain by others. And we will feel pain. We'll feel the pain of the body aging, what the Buddha called dukkha-dukkha, just the dukkha you can't avoid, of aging, of sickness, of pain in the legs, of loss of loved ones, these kinds of pains. But the feeling pain is different than suffering, about what, as Kirisara was saying last night, about what we then add to it through our mental pain. So each of the truths has a remedy, has a practice associated with it. So rather than avoiding this experience, the Buddha said this first his first noble truth of suffering, of dukkha, needs to be contemplated or understood or reflected on or turned to. So with the power of the mindfulness that we've been developing with the breath and the body, when dukkha arises, we can turn to that and contemplate it rather than be so frightened by it. So it's very different to work consciously with suffering, to overcome it, to transform it, to develop qualities of strength and courage and skills in meeting suffering than to unconsciously suffer. When we're consciously with suffering, we're not really suffering. Suffering's there, but we're not suffering from it. Usually what we do is just unconsciously suffer. This experience of dukkha, it originates. When the mind is the mind generating this from the causes of what conditions this experience of dukkha is connected with desire, with the desire and aversions of the mind. And subtly, very subtly, or quite coarse, three kinds of desire. It's kamma tanha, which means the desire, the mind not knowing its own nature. So nature is awareness, primordial, unshakable awareness. It seeks for an object to absorb into. It's called kamma tanha. It's a sensory desire. Constantly the mind's running out, looking and through the experience of the senses for something to absorb into, to find a sense of a place to land. Or bhava tanha, this other form of the feeling of always needing to become something else or to get something or arrive somewhere. I remember a great friend of ours in South Africa who was a top CEO of a huge company, mining industry. And towards the end of his working life, he was very successful, brilliant guy, with sort of working in the gold industry, and one day we were at one of his dinner parties, which were all these gold bankers and traders and kind of not your usual meditators company. So. And he was talking about, somehow I got into a conversation with him about his life and what it took to go and do the work he did, basically speculate on the stock market and sometimes lose millions of dollars and sometimes not. Very, very stressful. And he's talked about how he would So I said, well, how do you cope with that? And he said, well, you know, one of the things you do is drink a lot of wine in the evening and then, you know, enjoy the pleasures and the rewards of that lifestyle. But then he also confessed that he experienced a lot of fear. And then I said, well, what do you do with that? And he said, well, I just repress it. I said, well, what does that do? And he said, well, I have nightmares at night. And so we kind of, it was a very open moment. And I just sort of said, well, when do you ever get to stop? And he just said, well, when I'm successful. Yeah, so, you know, and that was, in a way, was stunning for me, because I should have done asked, well, what is success? What is success for us? Because there is this drivenness that we all experience, and then we translate that into our meditation. We want to get there somehow. We keep looking for the extra experience on top of what's happening. In Zen, they call it putting a head on top of a head. Looking for something else. It must be special. Or we do it in the world. You know, so it's this energy of bhava tanha keeps us moving and keeps us being driven. The whole world is sort of driven by this endless momentum. And until we really illuminate that energy, we're not really free from it. Or we become free from it through the third form of desire, which is called vipavatana, which is when we've had enough and we get burnt out, we want to just disappear. We don't want to exist. We don't want to feel anything. It's too difficult. And so these forms of, they're like energies that are in relationship to the moment, are constantly pushing and pulling at our experience. We want to get something more, we want to avoid what's here, and all of this generates this experience of dukkha. And so then in moments, as we've been practicing, in moments of just releasing out of those strategies of the mind, as it's demanding something from the moment, the more than what is, in moments when we release out of that, then we have this taste of peace. We open into another dimension. It's called Nirodha, the third noble truth. We have a moment. Nirodha literally means Ni means without roda walls or prison. It's like the mind, it tastes itself without any walls. It's not bound. It doesn't need to be bound. It doesn't need to be defined. It doesn't need to find a house. It tastes its own nature. It tastes peace. And as the Buddha said, there's no pleasure, no peace, nothing in the world that can compare with the release and the taste of Nibbana. So this is why sometimes, although suffering is not something one would wish upon ourselves or anyone, but why sometimes when we come to a point in our life of limitation and we can't control the situation in the way we used to, we can't get what we want, there's a moment of great potentiality, because we have to then look inward and have to find a whole other way of being. And so in this practice of in the first noble truth, suffering needs to be turned to be contemplated, so we can start to see what's generating suffering in the moment. In the second noble truth, when we see the wanting and the aversion of the mind, the Buddha said this needs to be relinquished, let go. And then in the moments of letting go, this third noble truth needs to be this peace. It's always here and now, always present, needs to be turned to and realized and tasted for ourselves. And the way of doing this is the fourth truth, the path that needs to be developed, which the heart of which is this practice of mindfulness, practice of awareness, practice of presence, being really, really present in this moment, steadying as we've been doing with the breath and body, and then investigating the dukkha here and now. It may be uncomfortable, maybe tired, maybe time for bed. But then, yes, all of that's like that. But then what do we add to the moment that generates suffering through our resistance or through our desire? So this is something we can, whatever situation we're in, and it's not to deny that there's not a time to really change the circumstance that we're living in. But in any situation, we can always practice this. What is the unnecessary suffering that we generate, and how in the moment, through just allowing things, life to flow as it is, to be as it is, how we can actually, the mind can turn and have a moment of release, tasting peace. And this is Ajahn Chah. When this is developed, the path becomes brought to more fruition, and the fruit of the path becomes more stable. It's the unshakable heart. This is how Ajahn Chah spoke about this fruit of this realization that the Buddha illuminated all that time ago. You will reach a point where the heart tells itself what to do. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surrounding, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at that pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So it's very auspicious to contemplate and come across this teaching on the Four Truths. This is the teaching through which the Buddha forged a whole new path. A path that's still present for us to walk, and actually was already a path that the Buddha saw had been walked by the ancient ones even before him. He said this path is like a path from the ancient times through a forest, leading to a great city, leading to Nibbana. So to whatever extent that we can pick up this teaching and contemplate it and work with it, it will bear fruits in our life and bring us to know, even if we lose connection and get overwhelmed, but it will bring us to know the way of peace, the deeper peace of the heart. So as we finish our practice today, may we wish for all beings, in whatever state they're in, whatever condition, wherever they are, that they taste peace, true peace and liberation from suffering.